All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 658 of the Divine Intervention podcast, right? And in today's podcast, we're going to be finishing up the series on health insurance, right? Again, if you missed part one and part two, you should go back and listen to those. I think you'll find those to be really helpful with your studying. So let's just jump right into it, right? So again, we've talked about a bunch of things. So let's maybe go into the discussion of just a few more kind of higher points that pop up on the exams, right? So let's talk about some managed care plans. I think that's kind of a useful thing to know, right? So first, so managed care plans, right? So let's kind of talk about these. I think as I discuss them, you understand why I classify them as managed care plans, right? So the first one is going to be a HMO, a health maintenance organization, right? So this is super restrictive. It can be pretty effective, but it is super restrictive, right? Basically, if you're a member of this kind of plan, you know, you must choose a primary care physician. And then that primary care physician is like the referee, right? They're like the gatekeepers, right? If you want to see any kind of specialist, you need to get a referral from the PCP, right? You need to get a referral from the PCP, right? Generally, they don't cover out-of-network care. Right. So if a physician is not within the HMO, you're not getting covered. Right. So out of network care, generally not covered except for like an emergency. Right. But it's like you're like, man, Divine, this is so restrictive. What do I get in exchange for this? Well, the thing you're going to get in return is the premiums are pretty low. Right. The premiums are pretty low. Right. And HMOs, they tend to use capitation to pay PCPs. Remember, we talked about capitation with the last podcast where it's like, oh, you get paid a fixed amount per patient, right? And we said that underutilization can be the bugaboo with that method of reimbursement. All right. So again, if they give you a question on your exams about a patient that, you know, for example, needs to see a cardiologist, hasn't got a referral from her PCP, right? And they're telling you that, oh, the HMO is not willing to pay for it. Then they ask you, like, what should this primary care physician do? Well, the primary care physician pick the answer that talks about, you know, helping the patient to navigate the referral process, documenting medical necessity so that person can get the care that they need, right? All right. So next, let's talk about a PPO, a preferred provider organization, right? So what in the world do I mean by a PPO, right? It's basically similar to a HMO, but it's more flexible, right? It's more flexible, right? You can pretty much see any provider. If you're a member of a PPO, right, you can pretty much see any provider in-network, out-of-network, doesn't matter, right? Without a referral. You don't need a referral on like what we have for HMO, right? But if you get care within the network, it costs less, right? If you get care within the network of physicians that the insurance company contracts with, it costs less. But if you get out of network care, it costs more, but it is still covered. It costs more, but it's still covered, right? So obviously, if you have more flexibility, you're going to be paying more premiums than we see with a HMO, right? So premiums are actually higher than we see with HMOs, right? So PPOs, preferred provider organizations, they don't use gatekeepers, right? They basically just pay providers on a fee-for-service basis, right? Although many times the PPO negotiates with these providers, you know, so they can get like these contracted rates. All right. Now, the next one is EPO, right? Exclusive Provider Organization. We're not talking about erythropoietin here, right? But EPO, right? It's kind of a hybrid, right? You don't need a referral, right? So like a PPO, but they don't cover out-of-network care, like we see with a HMO, right? Except for emergencies, right? So the premiums are kind of in between what you get charged with a HMO and a PPO, right? So think of it as a hybrid, right? It's like an in-betweener. It's like an in-betweener, right? You don't need referrals, but out-of-network care, they don't cover it, right? So it's more restrictive than a PPO, but is less restrictive than a HMO, right? So the premiums are kind of in between a HMO and a PPO, right? And then another managed care plan is what we call POS, right? So point of service, right? So it's another hybrid, right? So there's a network, there's a PCP, you know, kind of like a HMO, right? But they allow you to, they allow, you know, out of network care, but you need to do higher cost sharing. Right? It's kind of like a PPO, right? It's kind of like a PPO, right? So the point of service care, right? Again, it's a hybrid. There's a network, there's a PCP, right? Like a HMO. But if you want to see somebody outside of the network, that's fine. But you're going to pay a bigger amount. You're going to have bigger copays and deductibles. All right. Next, let's talk about a high deductible health plan, right? A high deductible health plan, right? So these plans have high deductibles, right? So, remember we talked about the difference between deductibles and copays and whatnot, right? So your deductibles here are higher for the care that you receive. So you're like, why would a person want to do that? Well, the reason you want to do this is in exchange, you get lower premiums. In exchange, you get lower premiums, right? So the thing is, these high deductible health plans, one thing that is super high yield to know about them for your exams is that we tend to pair them up with a HSA, with a health savings account, right? And you may be wondering, why would I want to do a health savings account? Well, the thing is, it pretty much allows you to use pre-tax dollars, you know, save up pre-tax dollars, use it for qualified medical expenses, right? So like, for example, you can essentially deduct the amount of money that you put in a health savings account. You can deduct that as a personal expense when you're filing your tax returns, right? And the thing is, if you don't use up the money for a HSA, you can actually just roll it over from year to year, right? This is very, very different from an FSA, a flexible spending account, right? A flexible spending account is kind of like a use it or lose it. If you don't use it, you pretty much lose it for most of those funds, right? So the thing is, again, remember, for a health savings account, you must be enrolled in a high deductible health plan, right? And again, the contributions can roll over. Some people actually use this for some pretty good tax advantages, but I'm not going to discuss that here. That's well beyond the scope of the USMLE exams. I'm not a tax accountant, right? HSA, right? Again, you can roll it, the contributions you put in, you can roll it over. Almost like in perpetuity in a sense, right? But again, we know that laws change all the time, right? And you're the one that owns the account. But compare this with an FSA, a flexible spending account, right? It's pretty much available with any employer plan, right? Even if it's not a high deductible health plan, right? But again, it's use it or lose it, right? They have slightly different expense rules and things like that. But again, that level of detail is probably not necessary for your exams, right? And then one other thing I think I want to talk about from the health insurance landscape, again, this last podcast here is just to kind of tee up some loose ends. You know, some quality metrics that occasionally you may see on your exams, right? Quality metrics, or you may see the term like utilization review, right? So let's kind of talk through these things, right? So the first one I want to talk about is HEDIS, right? HEDIS, right? It's actually an example of a quality measurement, right? What does HEDIS stand for? Well, basically, it means healthcare effectiveness data and information set. Healthcare effectiveness data and information set. Basically, this is a way to compare insurance plans apples to apples, right? Let me explain, right? So in fact, it's probably one of the, it's super, super widely used, right? One of the most widely used, set of quality measures in managed care, right? And it's maintained by an organization known as the NCQA, right? The National Committee for Quality Assurance, right? What does it track? It tracks a bunch of metrics, right? So things like breast cancer screening rates, A1C testing in diabetics, right? Childhood immunization rates, antidepressant medication management, right? And basically, like, it's like, hey, for this health insurance plan, what do their metrics look like for things like these? For this other health insurance plan, what do their metrics look like for these, right? So the thing is, it basically helps you compare, wait, this insurance plan versus this other insurance plan, like, Is this insurance plan associated with me getting my breast cancer screening, right? Do they have like pretty high breast cancer screening rates or A1C testing rates in diabetics and things like that, right? It's a very good way to compare one insurance plan to another, right? So if they give you a board question about how a health plan measures quality, HEDIS is going to be the right answer, HEDIS, right? It can actually help you identify gaps in how well this plan is doing. And, you know, it can help them, kind of make changes, right? Kind of make changes. Although, you know, that these insurance companies, they want to keep as much money as possible, as much of the premium, and do as little as possible, right? Again, any business is set up to make profit. All right. Now, another quality measure I want to talk about with a managed care plan, right? Think of a QALY, a quality adjusted life year, right? Basically, it represents 1 year of perfect health, right? 1 year of perfect health. That is literally what it means, right? And we tend to use it in cost effectiveness analysis, right? Because many times, and maybe let me break that down a little bit, right? So QLY, right? Many times, again, it represents, again, 1 year of perfect health, right? 1 year of perfect health, right? But you need to be careful because this is adjusted by a quality score, right? So say, for example, if something gives you 2 years of life, but it gives you 2 years of life at 50% quality, then it's like, wow, okay, you're only getting 1 year of perfect health from those 2 years of life, right? Because if you're living 2 years at 0.5 quality for each of those years, then 2 times 0.5 is 1, right? Or if something is giving you 4 years at 0.25 quality of life, four times 0.25, right? 25% quality of life, right? That's still giving you 1 year of perfect health, right? So the thing is, the way it works, it's almost like a standardized way to see the effectiveness of an intervention, right? Like, hey, how effective is this? But again, we tend to attach a cost to it, right? In fact, many times when we're doing cost effectiveness analyses, we do this thing called a cost per QALY, right? Because it helps you compare, like, hey, this intervention versus this other intervention, which one gives me the most QALY for the least cost, right? For the least cost, right? They like to, you know, test this in the context of, like, you know, cost effectiveness analysis, bioethics, health policy questions, right? So, you know, many of these health departments, they keep these things in mind, or these national organizations, they keep these things in mind when they're doing resource allocation, right? So it's a big time consideration when you're allocating scarce healthcare resources, right? Remember, healthcare resources are pretty much always scarce. And then another quality metric I want to talk about is utilization review, right? So what in the world is utilization review? This is something that's actually beginning to pop up quite frequently on the USMLE exams, right? So it's basically a process that an insurance company is going to use to evaluate if care is medically necessary, right? Is the care medically necessary? Is the care appropriate, right? And it basically comes in three forms, right? So there's like almost like the I like to think of it from a perspective of like almost like pre-renal AKI, intra-renal AKI, post-renal AKI. You're going to see what I mean as I go along, right? But the pre-renal AKI part of things, or analogous part of things here, is something called like prospective review, right? If you've ever heard of prior auth, this is what it is, right? Prospective review, right? Prospective utilization review is pretty much prior authorization, right? So the thing is, you got to get the approval from the insurance company before you get the service, right? This is actually pretty common for things like elective procedures or medications that are super expensive, or like certain inpatient admissions. Is like, hey, the insurance company has to put their stamp of approval on it. If not, you're not getting that thing. At least they're not going to cover it. Now, let's talk about the intrarenal AKI side of things, right? Let's call it concurrent review, right? Concurrent review, basically, the insurance company is keeping tabs on an inpatient stay. They're like monitoring it on an ongoing basis, right? They basically decide that, hey, is this person's hospitalization justified, right? Should we keep this person in the hospital like for 4 days or for 5 days or whatever? So, right, so they keep monitoring things, right? And then let's go to the postrenal AKI analogy of things here, right? This is retrospective review, right? Makes sense, right? Retro in the past, right? So this is basically like reviewing claims after the fact, right? Some insurance companies, they can review the claims after the fact and they can say, you know what? We're going to deny payment, right? You didn't meet certain criteria. We're not going to pay for this, right? Again, insurance companies sometimes, again, they're beneficial, but they can sometimes be the bane of a physician's existence, right? So the thing is, prior authorization, right, prospective review is one that they like to test quite frequently on the USMLE exams, right? So they give you a question about a physician, right? You know, the physician wants to order an MRI for a patient that has back pain, right? But then the insurer is asking for the medical necessity for this. This is basically a prior authorization question, right? So the thing is, the physician typically will have to document like medical necessity, you know, submit the request, and then hope that insurance accepts it, right? But they can give you a question on your exams where the insurer says, hey, we're not going to cover this. We're not going to cover this. So they ask you on your exams, what's going to be the most appropriate next step? Well, your most appropriate next step is to file an appeal, right? You need to file a formal appeal, right? And the thing is, if it's something that the patient needs urgently, you can actually do an expedited appeal. You can do an expedited appeal, right? And then the thing is, one thing you may see rarely, doesn't pop up frequently, but rarely may pop up on an exam, is something called the CON, the Certificate of Need, right? The Certificate of Need. Basically, like some states, they actually require some hospitals, you know, or facilities to say, hey, this is the need, this healthcare facility we want to build. This is the community need for it. This is the community need for it, right? So before you build a new healthcare facility or expand your current healthcare facility, right, you need to submit like a certificate of need in some states, right? It's kind of like a health planning tool, right? Because you want to control costs. You don't want to duplicate services, right? Like if we already have enough healthcare facilities to serve a particular need for a community, why do we need to build a new one? Why don't we use those funds instead to build something else that is not currently present in that community, right? So certificate of need, right? So basically, like, again, you need to demonstrate need in some states, right? It's not in every state, but in some states. All right. Now, I want to talk about some things that are kind of weird with regards to ethics and insurance, right? So, again, some of these terms you may see on your exams, right? So like a classic one you may see is adverse selection, right? So adverse selection basically is like, ooh, healthy people, they're like, nope, we're not getting insurance. Sick people, they're like, yes, we're definitely going to enroll for insurance, right? What do you think this is going to do in terms of premiums? It's going to drive up premiums, right? It's going to drive up premiums. It can destabilize an insurance market, right? So this was part of the thing that the Affordable Care Act was trying to deal with the individual mandate where, you know, basically like everybody signs up for insurance, right? Because it kind of counteracts adverse selection, right? Because it basically keeps healthy people in the pool. It makes sure that healthy people get insurance, right? But sick people also get insurance, right? To kind of counterbalance this adverse selection where it's like, wow, it's only sick people getting insured. Healthy people are not getting insured, right? And then another closely related concept to adverse selection is something called moral hazard, a moral hazard, right? So basically, like, it's like, hey, I have insurance, so I'm going to use more healthcare than I would otherwise, right? Because, hey, this cost is being distributed. I'm paying my premiums. I better get as much healthcare as I can get, right? That's a moral hazard, right? It's like, wow, care that you ordinarily wouldn't get, you're getting it basically because you have insurance. You feel like, okay, I have this blank check to use healthcare as much as possible, right? So how is this moral hazard curtailed, right? So again, the USMLEs, they like to test these concepts in the context of, hey, what can we do to kind of shut this down? What can we do to kind of curtail this? Well, the thing is high cost sharing, right? So things like deductibles, things like copays, right? That's one very classic mechanism to counteract moral hazard, right? If you know that, hey, okay, I'm going to get this care that you typically would not get, but you notice that, man, the deductible is pretty high. The copay is pretty high. That's probably going to make you think a little bit, think twice before you start jumping on those things, right? And then again, remember, as a physician, you have an ethical duty to advocate for your patients, right? Within these constraints of managed care, right? You have an ethical duty to advocate for your patients, right? If a necessary referral is denied, you need to appeal, right? Remember, your duty ultimately is to the patient. Even if you're enrolled in a managed care plan as a physician, right? Your ethical duty, your fiduciary duty is to the patient, not to the insurance company, right? So just keep that in mind, right? And then just a few quick things on health disparities, right? Remember, right, again, they love to test this on the exams, right? It's classic USMLE bots further, right? But basically, remember, people that are uninsured, right, they are more likely to be in minority groups, right? Blacks, Hispanics, right, low-income people, immigrants, right? Or residents of these ACA non-expansion states. Remember, I talked about what the expansion means in an earlier podcast, right? So, and the thing is, if you don't have insurance, you're going to get delayed diagnoses. You're going to get worse outcomes in pretty much every chronic disease, right? Right? You're going to have much higher rates of preventable hospitalizations, bigger utilization of emergency rooms, right? So just things to keep in mind for your exams, right? And then they also like you to know about the social determinants of health, right? Again, the USMLEs, they want to essentially be able to connect insurance status, you know, from, you know, like a broader social context, right? So the thing is, a person that is uninsured, a person that doesn't have health insurance, that's usually not the only problem that they have, right? They may have food insecurity. They may not have access to food, right? They may live in a food desert, right? They may have like housing instability. They may have like transportation barriers, right? That basically prevent them from accessing care, right? Because think about it. If you need to go and visit a doctor, but you don't have transportation to get there, how are you going to get there? Literally, how are you going to get there, right? Or if you're homeless, right? Again, it may make it difficult for you to go to a doctor's office, right? To go to a doctor's office, right? So the thing is, again, they can give you questions like these, revolve around these concepts, right? And they ask you, hey, what's the most appropriate next best step in management, right? And the answer may be doing things like, you know, connecting the patient to a community health center or referring them for a food assistance program or referring them for transportation services, right? Not just prescribing medications, right? And again, remember this thing about like the nutrition programs like WIC and SNAP and whatnot. I talked about that in the nutrition podcast. All right. Now, how about an FQHC? What in the world is an FQHC? A Federal Qualified Health Center, right? So they love to test this on the exams, right? Basically, it's a health center that serves patients regardless of ability to pay. Regardless of your ability to pay, right? And they use like a sliding fee scale, right? So the more money you make, the more you pay. The less money you make, the less you pay, right? And the thing is, these FQHCs, they tend to get kind of better reimbursement from Medicare and Medicaid, right? There's literally like federal laws, right? That's why they're called federally qualified. You have to be qualified to receive this kind of a reimbursement, right? So if they give you a question about a kind of clinic that serves, you know, an uninsured low-income patients on the USMLE exams, pick the answer that talks about an FQHC, right? Pick the answer that talks about a federally qualified health center. Right. And then don't forget EMTALA. Right. EMTALA is another concept you want to know for your exams. Right. It's the Emergency Medical Transport and Active Labor Act. Right. EMTALA. Right. Basically, what is the key thing you want to know about EMTALA? If you have any hospital that has an emergency room that receives Medicare funding, you must screen anyone that presents. Right. Regardless of the insurance, regardless of the ability to pay. Right. And you must stabilize a person that has an emergency condition. They got to get stabilized, right? And then, or you need to transfer appropriately, right? So EMTALA doesn't guarantee that, hey, you're going to get all the care you need. No, it just guarantees that, hey, you present to an emergency room that gets reimbursed with Medicare, you need to get stabilized, right? So again, a hospital cannot turn away a patient in labor, right? And they'll use a specific scenario on your exams, right? They're not just going to use like a small definition. No, they're going to give you a question about a patient that is in labor, right? Or a patient that has an acute MI and the person is uninsured and the person presents to an emergency room. The emergency room cannot turn that patient away. You need to take care of the patient. You need to stabilize them or transfer them as appropriate, right? And one thing to know about Medicare that, you know, you should probably just keep in mind for your exams and also just for clinical practice, honestly, right, is the two, although remember, this podcast is not for clinical practice, it's just to give you tips, okay, exam prep. That's my primary goal with this podcast here. But the thing is, there's this thing called the two midnight rule, right? Basically, Medicare is going to pay for inpatient hospitalization, right? When the physician essentially expects the patients to spend two or more midnights in the hospital, right? So if you admit a patient and they end up staying less than two midnights, Medicare actually reclassifies it in many cases, right? They reclassify it as an outpatient observation stay, right? And that has very different coverage implications, right? Very different coverage implications, right? So just going to keep this at the back of your mind, right? That two midnight rule is kind of important, right? So again, remember, across this podcast series, we've talked about many things, right? We talked about Medicare and how, again, it's mostly for people over 65, or if you're going to be Social Security disabled for like 24 plus months, right? Or you have ESRD or ALS, right? We talked about Part A with, you know, inpatient stay, hospital stays, Part B with, you know, outpatient, visits, Part C, Medicare Advantage, Part D with prescription drugs, right? Remember, Medicare doesn't cover custodial care, right? And again, to be admitted to for Medicare to pay for a skilled nursing facility, you need to have been in the hospital for 3 days, right? Remember, Medicaid is like a joint program between the feds and the states, right? You know, covers low-income groups, right? Covers long-term custodial care, right? So keep that in mind, right? And then remember CHIP, right? The Children's Health Insurance Program, right? For kids up until age 19, right? Many times you're going to see this with families that are, you know, they make too much money to be eligible for Medicaid, but they cannot afford a private insurance, right? And then remember in the previous podcast, I talked about payment models, right? Fee-for-service, capitation, diagnosis-related groups, accountable care organizations. You do need to know those things, right? And then in this podcast, I've talked about HMOs, right? The different managed care plans, right? HMOs, PPOs, EPOs, right? High deductible health plans, health savings accounts, flexible spending accounts. You got to know these things for your exams, right? You know, HEDIS measures, QLOIs, utilization review, right? The different kinds. Remember the pre-intrarenal and post-renal AKI analogy that I use, right? Talked about EMTALA, right? So just make sure you know these things, right? They love to test them on the exams, right? They love to test them on the exams. And many times these things are, you either know it or you don't. If you know it, you'll get the question right. If you don't know it, you're screwed, right? So don't be screwed on your exams. And if you love the way I teach, you're going to love the classes that I teach, right? So starting the middle of this month, the 15th, basically, I have a bunch of classes that are very helpful for step one to step three, right? So third week in this month, I begin with a CCS class, right? A step three CCS class. It's a 1 hour class. And then I have and that's just for step three, right? And then for step one to step three, I have a biostatistics class that's 4 hours long, a social sciences and ethics class that's 5 hours long, right? And again, many and a test-taking strategies class that's 2.5 hours long, right? Many people take these classes and find them to be really, really helpful, right? And they're all over Zoom. And again, it's not me giving a lecture. It's me using questions and practice problems to teach you concepts, to teach you content, to teach you strategy, right? And then for step two and step three specifically, I have a last-minute review that's 3 hours long. Oh, so many people love that class, right? And then I have a 20-hour step two, step three class that, again, a lot of people have taken and found to be extremely helpful. I've literally had people get as high as 280s from taking my review classes, my 20-hour step two class, my 50-hour step two, step three class, right? And then I have a 25-hour step one review, right? It's for people taking step one or people that have poor foundations, poor basic science foundations that are taking step two or step three, right? So thank you for listening to me in this podcast. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and Comlex exams. I have my podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel as well where I post the podcast that I make, right? And remember, I also help with ERAS applications, personal statements, mock interviews. I help with application edits and things like that. And then I have another website known as DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com, DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post like one podcast where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. Many people actually listen to it every week. I have like 400 podcasts on there and I keep adding more and more new ones every single week, right? So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 659, right? I can't wait for the day where Divine Intervention podcast gets to 1,000. I guess we'll see. All right. So have a wonderful day. God bless you and I bye for now. Thank you.